No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. We have a very special guest tonight, but first let me say hello to my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and wish her a happy St. Patrick's Day. How are you, Maria?
Quite, thank you, Michael. We're having the first blush of spring. We've had unprecedented cold temperatures for Southern California, like as long as they've been keeping records. So my winter garden is flourishing, and I made corned beef from scratch for the first time this week and had my sons over for dinner last night.
Yay.
I've always bought it prepared, and I read a recipe last Sunday, and so you brine it for 6 days, and then I put it in the slow cooker all day yesterday, and it was unbelievable. I'll never not do it again.
Well, now you're going to have Mrs. Brown all over me, because she's upstairs cooking corned beef and cabbage right now, and I don't think she brined hers.
Okay.
So now I'm going to have to yell at her.
Yeah, it's literally, you can cut it with a fork. It's mouthwatering. Let's just put it this way. There were no leftovers.
All right. Yeah. Well, there won't be any leftovers tonight either. Mrs. Brown makes a pretty good corned beef and cabbage, and we have it every St. Patrick's Day. And you know, my father was one of those guys that he was French on Bastille Day. He was Irish on St. Patrick's
Aww.
Day. He was, Aww. You know, he loved to revel in the differences between different cultures. So it's always fun. I will say that when I was in college, I drank my share of green beer. We used to go out. It was a tradition to go out every St. Patrick's Day. Now I think you can buy it in stores, but in those days, I think you could only get it on draft, and we used to go to our favorite Irish pub here in Washington, D.C., and have green beer every St. Patty's Day. And
see, I won't contribute to that. Like, I go to a Mexican restaurant on St. Patty's Day and have green margaritas, or tonight I'm going for sushi and going to have green sushi or sake. It's just like going to a Mexican restaurant on Cinco de Mayo. I mean, it's like amateur night, trouble, no thank you. I'd rather stay home.
Oh my gosh.
But you were young phone calls, and foolish.
And we were the ones causing the trouble.
Yes.
We were the ones, we were the people that were there that kept people like you from coming there.
Sure.
Drunk teenagers. Because, you know, back when I was a kid, when I was in college, you could drink at 18 in the District of Columbia.
Wow.
So now I think it's 21. But everybody from the suburbs in Virginia and Maryland
would come in.
Because the drinking age was 21. So, you didn't want to go to if you're over 21 years old, you probably didn't want to go to a bar in the district on the weekends anyway.
Now, yeah. I have one last story about that. I have a girlfriend. She's married to a Patrick Walsh.
Yeah.
He was one of, I think, 6 children. He was born on St. Patrick's Day and named Patrick in an Irish Catholic family. So you can imagine how elevated his life has been ever since.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey, which was an Italian neighborhood when my parents grew up. I lived in my Italian grandmother's house. But when I grew up, it was a Catholic neighborhood. So it was Irish, it was Italian, it was a Latino. But that was the one thing that we all had in common. We're all Catholics. So we had big celebrations on St. Patrick's Day. Of course, my grandmother, being Italian, didn't think a whole lot of the Irish, but I think she used to say that St. Patrick didn't drive the snakes out of Ireland. They left on their own. But we always reveled in the celebration, and certainly America. I've been involved in the labor movement in America, and the Irish have always played a big role in the development of the great country we have today. So all the people out there of Irish ancestry, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Well, and then the Italians would celebrate St. Joseph's Day as their holiday.
Yes, we celebrated many things. We took credit for everything. With the Virgin Mary, Jesus was Italian. The Virgin Mary was Italian. We often used to say, "Thank God my grandmother didn't live to see a non-Italian pope," because for 500 years, all the popes were Italian. So, in the Italian Catholic Church, we had great festivals, but St. Joseph, his feast day was one of the big, and for some reason, St. Teresa, I don't know if St. Teresa was Italian or not, but that was a big feast day. And of course, my patron saint when I was a kid, the saint that I loved most was St. Dominic, who was Italian, who died very young as a martyr, and somebody that I always admired. My mother, though, being a crazy Italian lady, made me take St. Anthony as my patron saint, because she made some deal when I was born. That's how Italian ladies are, So when I picked Dominic, she said, "Nope, it's going to be Anthony."
Well, and just FYI, St. Joseph's Day is on Tuesday. It's March 19th. My sister's birthday is tomorrow, so she gets the bump of St. Patrick's Day, her birthday, and then St. Joseph's Day. So she gets caught up in all of that too, which I think is adorable. at our age.
I'll have to make some pasta. That's my favorite. I'm a diabetic and I'm trying to lose some weight, so I've been off the pasta for a long time. But
there's all kinds of pasta now that you can make that isn't made from grain.
I know, but come on.
Good. I've had some of it.
Well, look, we have our special guest with us tonight.
Okay. Yes.
And let me introduce her.
Such an honor.
Yes, it's such an honor. She's just been elected to her 15th term.
Oh, my goodness.
In Congress. Yes, consecutive term. She gets more votes than anybody in Washington. She's a civil rights icon. I can't give you her whole bio because that would take the whole show. But let me tell you that she just recently received the honor of being designated by the Center for Effective Lawmaking at UVA and Vanderbilt University as the most effective Democrat in Congress, which is really saying something, since she doesn't have a vote on the floor of the House. She's amazing. We call her our warrior on the Hill, Eleanor Holmes Norton. Congresswoman Norton, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, glad to be with you. I have to live up to that.
Well, if anybody can do it, it's you. A few elections ago, I got 207,000 votes, and I thought, gee, finally, I've gotten the most votes. But no. I didn't get as many as you did. So anyway, before we talk about all that's gone on with statehood, can I ask you, a few weeks ago was the 50th anniversary of the crossing of the Pettus Bridge in Selma, the March to Selma. I know that you were part of the celebration, and you were part of everything that went on during the civil rights movement down there. We could go on and on, but how did that feel? How do you feel about the progress that America has made in civil rights over the past 50 years?
When you consider where we were when I was a kid in the civil rights movement and where we are now, no one can doubt the progress. That is why whenever we see slippage, we try to catch it. Remember, we got three great civil rights bills, one right after another, and you began to see immediate progress. Selma is one of those great events in that march. It was indeed a march toward that kind of a victory. Now, when you look at the Congress of the United States, where I serve, you will see that there are 53 black members of the House of Representatives. I mean, that is many times what it was at the time of the Selma March. So there's no doubt that there's been progress, even as we continue to struggle for the kind of equality that I think every American deserves.
Well, on that note, on Friday, you were on the Kojo Nandi show, and you said that in the past 3 months, we've made more progress than we've made in the past 218 years on the issue of D.C. statehood. And I mean, I think that's amazing. I agree with you. But can you explain to our listeners why that is, exactly what's gone on lately that makes it such a great time?
Yeah, I use that 218 because I think that's about how old the country is, or how old it is that we've been the nation's capital and struggling to be equal with other Americans, and have tried, and we've tried everything you know best in these last few years of things we tried. For example, we were close to getting the House vote. In fact, we got it through the House and the Senate. And then the National Rifle Association attached what is called a rider or an amendment that would have, in exchange, if you call that exchange, wiped out all our gun laws. So we had to leave that vote on the table. And since then, we've been struggling for statehood, as difficult as that is to get. Now the Democrats control the House, and we now have 201 co-sponsors. We're close to getting that vote through the House of Representatives, and that's what I mean by closer than we've been in 218 years.
Yep, absolutely. And not only that, but HR1, which is amazing, right? Because the House has now really for the first time officially endorsed the idea of D.C. statehood, have they not?
Yes, indeed. H.R. 1 is a kind of prelude. It's kind of the John the Baptist to H.R. 51, and you will see what 51, of course, stands for. But H.R. 1 is very important we got in that bill. That is the Democrats' all-encompassing democracy bill. What it shows is how many ways the entire country isn't as democratic as we should be. For example, there's everything in it from wiping out gerrymandering by making sure there would be independent commissions who dealt with how the states who dealt with that particular function. It's got voting on Saturday. I mean, it tries to expand democracy beyond where we are. So when I saw we had a comprehensive democracy bill, I said I wanted to be in it.
And asked the
leaders who were putting together HR1 to put the district in it. And boy, did we get in it. Because what they decided to do, since remember, there's no single district or state in HR1. So the way they flummoxed that was to put all of the findings, 8 or 10 findings, which are even better than HR1, frankly, all the reasons why the district should be the 51st state are laid out right there in HR1. So it's just where we need to be as we try to march toward the first vote for statehood in the House of Representatives, and I expect
And Congresswoman, thank you for your not only your time, but for all that you've done for our country for half a century, if not longer. Talk about inspirational. And if you had a crystal ball, what would you see statehood looking like in the near future? What steps would have to unfold in order for that to be possible?
Well, what has to happen now? What has to happen now is we have to get to 218 votes. We're not going to ask for the vote on the House floor until we have 218 co-sponsors, because 218 is the number by which we would win the House of Representatives, at least. We would still have a Senate to go, but I like to think of this as I think most of us do when we get a very difficult bill through the House. We're more than halfway there. To get things through the Senate take longer, but if you've gotten through the House, you're well on your way to getting the full measure.
Wow.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, Congresswoman, but Elijah Cummings, a dear friend of our cause and a personal friend of yours, I believe, has promised to have a hearing on the bill, which would be the first, I believe, the first since 1994.
Yes, he has already. You know, when you hear how far we've gone, one way to see how far we've gone is to judge by who is for us and what their role is. And you've made a very important point. Elijah Cummings is the head of the committee. We'd have to go through. That's the committee on which I serve. It's Oversight and Government Reform. He has promised a hearing. That's the hearing that's necessary to get us to the House floor. Before we are at the House floor, we already have the Speaker of the House offering the strongest kind of endorsement for statehood. And she did that just as the session began. Senator Tom Carper in the Senate has already broken his own record and already has 30 Democrats, that's most of the Democrats in the Senate, on the bill. Now, that's where we are now, and what are we, barely 3 months of the Congress?
Right.
So I should think that with a little more work, and D.C., and you, Senator, and D.C. residents have been putting in that work, that we ought to be able to before the end of the 16th Congress,
yes,
we ought to be through the House of Representatives.
Wow.
Well, and you know, and we did, and in addition to Senator Carper, you have every senator that is running for president right now: Booker, Gillibrand, Klobuchar, Harris, Sanders, and Warren, all on the bill. Every senator from Delmarva, Maryland, Virginia, New Jersey, and Delaware, for the first time, Mark Warner, who I used to share an office with, is on the bill. And you have Senator Chuck Schumer saying it's, you know, our minority leader saying it's a priority. I mean, and most of the credit for that, as we all know, Congresswoman, goes to you. So thanks for your hard work.
Thank you for bringing those up. And Chuck Schumer says that there are three priorities for democracy, and he names D.C. as one of them. So you can't do better than that.
Can't do better than that. But, of course, when things are going smoothly, right, danger's at the door. So, once again, retrocession periodically raises its ugly head. There was something in the Washington Post, a letter the other day, about retroceding back to Maryland, and, you know, which is a form of statehood, actually. But explain to our listeners, Congresswoman Norton, why we don't want retrocession, why we want statehood.
Yeah, well, why in the world that would be raised now when it is clear that neither jurisdiction wants it, neither Maryland nor D.C. D.C. has, after 218 years, become a flavor of its own independent jurisdiction. There's no way you can incorporate into someplace else. But that someplace else, Maryland, doesn't want to be incorporated. In fact, there was a poll taken not too many years ago in which the representatives, the state representatives from Maryland, overwhelmingly voted against retrocession for D.C. So that's some kind of far-out notion that does not come from either jurisdiction, which makes it illegitimate.
Yeah, well, I always marvel in the fact that people that write those letters are always from Virginia. they're neither from Maryland or the District of Columbia. They're always seem to be from Virginia. Maria, I don't want to monopolize the Congresswoman's time. Do you have a question?
I do, and thank you for that. I'm just curious what, Congresswoman, you think the reason there is for the momentum of these past 3 months that is unparalleled and unprecedented.
What do I think is the reason for it?
Yes.
Well, I think in what you want to do in the House, if you want to get something done, is before the session gets all crowded up with all kinds of business, you want to move it as fast as you can. And remember, a lot of folks have been working on this for a long time as a senator. Mm-hmm. So by the time the gavel hit the board, we were ready to go. We had already gotten, last year, before we were in the majority, almost as many members on the bill, so we didn't have far to go. Who we're working on now are some of the freshmen. We got some freshmen, but the freshmen, we have a great number of freshmen who are here by only 4 or 5 votes, so we have to work a little harder on them, especially since, as I think the senator will tell you, most people in the United States think we already have the same rights they have.
Right.
So these freshmen have come here not even knowing about statehood. Mm-hmm. So we think we will get them, even those who are here by close votes.
And how about a changing sentiment? You know, we hear about what's gone on in places like Georgia and South Carolina with voter suppression, and that's made the headlines in the last election. And really, the ultimate form of voter suppression is in the District of Columbia, is it not, where 702,000 of us don't have an equal voice in our government. Do you think that's played a role? Yes. You think that's played a role?
In where? In what?
In getting more people enthusiastic. I mean, obviously, the footwork that you've done in the House to get the co-sponsors is one thing. But, you know, I think it was a surprise for all of us to have people, maybe not Pelosi, because she's spoken so eloquently on the issue in the past, but to have people like Schumer come out and other people come out and H.R. 1 and all this stuff, you know, to see this, what really feels like momentum that's building behind
there's
us.
There's no question it's momentum. You would not have all these presidential candidates, for example, every last one of them, all signing on to statehood, I mean on the bill, if they didn't feel, I got to get on this momentum, I got to get on this train while it's still, you know, at this juncture so I won't be late. There's a huge amount of momentum now, and what your job, Senator, and mine, is to help keep this momentum going until we finally get that vote in the House of Representatives. I think we can do that if we just keep the enthusiasm we see now as the Congress begins throughout this year.
Well, and let me ask you, too, since you brought up presidential candidates, you're a superdelegate, I believe, and I've been a superdelegate. What do you think about there's a movement inside D.C. to change the date of our primary, because our primary is the last primary. It's in June. Do you think that would help us at all to move the primary up? Because it seems to me that the decision on who our nominee is going to be will be made before they get to the district.
Well, I certainly sympathize with all of those in D.C. who are trying to get greater attention paid to D.C. by getting an early primary, but I've got to put on my political hat here and say that while I certainly think it could be useful, I'm not sure how useful. because the district is an overwhelmingly Democratic jurisdiction. So unless there is some real play, and I don't know at this moment who they will be, but unless there is some real play among the nominees, the district isn't the kind of jurisdiction you look at to see as to see a bellwether for what is going to happen. So the most it could do for us is to help us focus on statehood, if it would do that. But I don't
we
think it
in California, we moved our primary from June to March. And I think that was because...
Yeah, and you know what, you got... there's a reason why that counts. That is going to give a boost to your candidate who's running. California was in the rear, and it's got more, I think, delegates than anybody else.
Yeah.
So California was tired of bringing up the rear.
Yeah.
Was a very powerful Democratic state and was tired of wasting its power by bringing up the rear.
Mm-hmm. And as a voter, I appreciate being in the process instead of an afterthought, too.
Exactly.
Well, you know, we could change that dynamic, Congresswoman, by putting forth a favorite daughter candidacy. Do you have any thoughts of being our candidate?
Not a thought on that. Don't think that'll get us much traction either.
that only proves how smart you really are. Because it looks like a challenge these days. Maria, is there anything else you would like to ask Congresswoman Norton? I know she has a very busy schedule, so we don't want to keep her too long.
Okay, I'm always interested, Congresswoman, in how you defied the traditions and the expectations of the time in which you came to do what you did with your social activism and your social justice causes. As a woman and as a woman of color, what gave you the audacity and the temerity and the chutzpah to go ahead and do what your heart told you to do and your passion said that you should do?
You know, if I think about it, I think I was kind of born this way. I'm the oldest daughter, and I'm born in a city that had no rights whatsoever. It didn't even have a mayor and a city council, much less a member of Congress. So when you're born into that kind of inequality, you're kind of born to do something about it. So I think I owe a lot to the fact, way before I got, I decided to run for Congress. I owe a lot to the fact that I'm from the District of Columbia, which is the least empowered jurisdiction in the United States. So if that's, and remember, I was also born in a segregated city and went to segregated public schools. So, you know, there's a lot there going for you that you've got to,
that you've
got
to
fight.
Wind in your sails, but so many before you would just give up. You know, just like shrug their shoulders or say, well, that's the way it's always been. That's the way it's always going to be. Sometimes I've heard that even from District of Columbia residents who have resigned themselves to this is the way it is. We've had them as guests on our program.
I give a lot of credit to this, having been a very young person as the civil rights movement started. I can remember when the civil rights movement started. I thought, what took you so long? But I think if you came to consciousness as the civil rights movement started, and you happen to be in the District of Columbia, you know, there are all kinds of signals that this is the time to go. So I think a lot of it is just born at the right time.
Wow.
That was certainly brave of you.
Yeah, and you certainly were born at the right time for us, Congresswoman. And for those of you that don't know, a lot of the people that started the statehood movement, the most recent statehood movement, came out of the civil rights movement, actually for home rule in the District of Columbia. Yeah, Dr. King, and you know, and that's another thing you say about young people, right? I think people forget that this man, Dr. Martin Luther King, changed the world and only lived to be 39 years old. And so let me make that my last question to you, Congresswoman. How do you feel about this new injection of young people? I know it's been controversial. Some of the Democrats who have come into Congress recently in the recent elections, and this new push towards millennials being more involved. You think that's a positive thing overall?
The movement of millennials to do what? I'm sorry.
To be more involved in the electoral process. They seem to, you know, we see these really outspoken people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez
in Congress.
Yes, in Congress.
Look, I'm very pleased because these are part of our new majority. I have to caution you, though, about some of what has been happening. If you had the experience I have had, where I've been in the minority, everything I've done for the district I've had to do in the minority, where my first 2 years were in the majority, then gone. Finally, 4 years in the majority, then gone. In other words, most of my time spent in the minority. Then you ask yourself, how do you stay in the majority? Well, it is not Cortez's. You stay in the majority because of those who are here, the ones I spoke of earlier by 4 or 5 votes. Mm-hmm. So my only caution about her and the other young women is they've got to start thinking about our majority because they could lose it for us. For example, when she talks about socialism, that Trump is deep into, that's a major, she's speaking for herself. She's not speaking for our caucus. That has become a major talking point for his campaign. So I do think, and this, I speak as somebody who's been in Congress for some time, and I think they are beginning to understand this, that those who are here, such as Alexandria Cortez, in safe seats, need to be more thoughtful about our majority because they did not make our majority. Who made our majority were those who are here by the skin of their teeth. We've got to help them too.
That's such great advice.
Really is.
And how, I mean, spoken like the true elder stateswoman that you are.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, I hate to sound like an old fuddy-duddy.
You just sound wise, and it's wonderful advice. And I hope she takes.
And I think they would agree with it. I just think they are, like you'd expect young members. You know, if they got here, they are spreading their wings. They are tremendously talented and articulate, and they are not thinking about how they got here. They got here because of members of their class, and you don't hear from them. Have you noticed? You do not hear from them. They buy their time. They know what it takes to stay here. So after a while, I think it's going to all sink in.
Well,
we
gotta
be charitable. We got to be loving to the ones who got us the majority, and they weren't those of us who were in safe seats.
Right.
Well, and you know, all three of us are parents, so I think we all understand that with young people. I think I was a communist for 2 days when I was in college until I realized it was no money in it, and then I went back to being a capitalist. But well, Congresswoman, before we let you go, is there anything you want to add? Anything?
I think you have been very thorough, and it has been delightful to talk with both of you.
Thank you.
I so appreciate your having me on to spread the word about what has been happening for D.C. statehood in the Congress.
Well, and we're going to have you back for our big celebration show when that bill gets passed in the House. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, terrific. Always glad to do it.
Thank you again
for all of your service.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Well, you know, great to have her on. And
that's
and,
history.
Yeah, it really is. And you know,
I wanted to ask her if she knew Dick Gregory because you know how passionate I am about him.
No, she did know Dick. She knew Dick Gregory well. Dick Gregory And Eleanor Holmes Norton used to protest on a regular basis, not only outside the South African embassy together, but also for statehood. The two of them, I'm pretty sure, were arrested together on several occasions. But yes, and I know this because I knew Dick Gregory, and he always spoke just glowingly about Congresswoman Norton. She was real. She really was an icon. When she was in law school, I believe she went to Yale, but when she was in law school, she used to go down and get freedom riders out of jail. You know, this is when she was a college student. You know, it's funny to hear her say, you know, she thought to herself, what took you so long to get to, you know, because I used to go when I was in college to war protests on the mall, but I went because that's where the kids were. We were like, wow, it's a party. You know, yes. I mean, yes. We weren't getting anybody out of jail. We were going down, you know, in our tie-dye T-shirts trying to be cool with everybody else. So to hear her say, you know, she felt like it took her a long time. That's just amazing. And, you know, this honor that you recently received from the Center for Effective Lawmaking at UVA and Vanderbilt University, they said in calling her the most effective Democrat in the previous session of Congress, the reason they gave her that award or that title was because she had kept so many riders off bills that were coming into the District of Columbia, that were trying to affect the laws in the District of Columbia. And she really has been, had to fight, you know, she's had to fight every day that she's been in there. And
well,
and
so, but that's why I find it remarkable. I mean, I know she only knows what it's like to be her, but from the outside, if you're born into segregation and if everything you see is oppressive and racist and limiting, most people, that's their status quo. But right. She saw it as a challenge and as an opportunity to create change, which I'm the eldest child and the eldest daughter in my family too. I conformed to authority. I, you know, it was either my folks' way or out the dough. And for her to question the very fabric and fiber of that with which she was brought up, it's like she was speaking a different language.
Well, you know, it's funny that another icon and friend, again, dear friend of Congresswoman Norton's, John Lewis, at the dedication of the Martin Luther King Memorial, which I was lucky enough to be part of here in Washington. And by the way, I don't want to digress here, but if you're thinking of coming to Washington, now's the time, because the cherry blossoms are about to bloom and the Martin Luther King Memorial is in the center of the cherry blossom grove. It's just really
I was
beautiful.
There last year.
Yeah.
I was at the peak weekend.
Yeah, well, there you go. And you know, Lewis said that his parents got all over him when he went to help Dr. King. And they told him, no, stay away from this man.
Right.
This man's a troublemaker.
Right.
He's only going to get you hurt. He's, and what parent out there can't relate to that, right?
Exactly.
What parent, right? Because we all want to keep our kids safe.
And, right. Shush.
You know,
shush,
right.
Don't and, make waves.
Right. Don't make
don't
waves.
Don't stick out. Just
right.
get along.
Don't, right. And certainly Lewis said that he understood their sentiment, you know, and I think a lot of African Americans, I think we still see it today, you know, a lot of people that are held down have a hard time seeing any other way than the way that's always been. So, yeah, God bless people like Eleanor Holmes Norton who see a different path and who want to take it in. And the man that you studied, Dick Gregory, and so many other people. You know, you came to our event here, Maria, and we all sat there and watched that play, Turn Me Loose. Mm-hmm. And how much courage did it take for this man to be invited to perform on the Johnny Carson show, which is like the holy grail
Jack
for a
Park.
Stand-up. I'm sorry, Jack Park, right? Because it was the Tonight Show, but it was before Johnny Carson.
Right.
The Jack Parr show, which is the holy grail, right?
For, commerce,
for a stand-up,
right.
comedian and him saying, no, if I can't sit on the couch like the white comedians, I don't want to do it.
Yep. You and know? Jack Parr had to call him himself and say, I understand you've turned my people down several times. What's the problem? And that's when he explained to him. He said, unless I get to sit on the couch, I'm not going to be on your show. And he said, no problem. But the fact that he had the guts to talk about ethics and morals, that he's not going to sell himself
right.
at all costs just for that notoriety.
Right.
I mean, principles, it brings tears to my eyes. Because Hollywood is known for people turning themselves inside out, the casting couch, this whole Me Too thing, doing whatever it takes to become a star and losing a part of yourself. And he was going to have none of it.
Yeah. Even kicking in 500 grand to get your kid into college. Oh. I mean, you know, right? It's the things that we do. And I don't think that, you know, if you took a poll in America, I don't think that you find very many parents that think it's right to spend $500,000 to get your kid into college. But I bet you'd be hard pressed to find one that doesn't understand how that happens, right? Because you want the best for your kids, and you want, you know, that serious misjudgment on those people's part. But you certainly can understand, we always want the best for our children, and well, conformity is easy.
I had a story. I took my second son to college when he was a freshman to get into the dorms and all of that stuff. And the school was my alma mater as well. And the campus is closed off to any vehicles other than bicycles and the little utility golf carts that the maintenance folks drive around. And so one of the last things we did was go to the bike store and get a bike. And then you have to get a bumper on it because it rains a lot. This is in Northern California. And otherwise, they call it the freshman stripe. The rain comes around and wets your back. So when the guy said to me, oh, it's going to be, I don't know, 7 to 10 days before we get to it because we're back ordered. And I was like, oh, shoot, I didn't know that. I said, is there any chance that there's some incentive that could put his bike to the front of the line? What beer do you drink? And he told me what beer, and he said, sure. So I said to my son, graft and corruption is alive and well. We went to the store and got him 2 six-packs, and when we came back, his bike was done.
Well, there
the
you
one
go.
And only time I've done something that hasn't been perfectly to the law, but it was like, because he would have to walk to campus, then he'd have to walk to get the bicycle, and all. And this way it was all taken care of. But
well, yeah, I got
that was $5.
Yeah. Well, when I was 18 years old, I drove from Phoenix, Arizona to Guatemala in my Pinto, which was saying something back then. There wasn't even a road through Mexico, but I was with two of my buddies. And one of the things that we enjoyed most was bribing the local policeman. Because you could, you know, they would pull you over and they tell you you were speeding. And they'd say, you know, you got to pay a speeding ticket for 50 pesos. And we'd say 20 pesos. And they'd say 25 pesos. And, you know, and I think we sped on purpose occasionally just so we could do that. Because 25 pesos in those days was about $3 or something. So,
gosh, that's a story that you haven't shared. You could have been in trouble there.
Yeah, I think the kind of guys that pulled us over, usually in t-shirts, barefoot, with Policia spray painted on the side of their car. We're not actually the Federales that you might have
Policia.
To worry. Yeah, who might actually take umbrage with your. In fact, I'll tell you, when we first went into the country, we came into the country and we had to get a vehicle permit. So I owned a Ford Pinto, but I bought it from my brother. So we never bothered to change the registration of the car.
Right.
And so we came in and they said, you know, they saw our driver's licenses and everything. And they said, okay, who's the owner of the car? And I said, me. And they said, well, it says here that the owner of the car is Paul Brown. And I said, because I never even thought about it. I said, yeah. And they said, well, you can't bring a car owned by somebody else into another country, which makes sense, right?
Right.
So I was like, oh. So then the cop stood, the custom agent stood in front of the door, to the driver's door. And he said, no, senor, you don't understand. You can't bring the car into the country. And I said, okay, well, we'll go back to the United States. And he's like, no. He kept on saying, no, you can't understand. I thought, oh, my God, we're in trouble. We're going to get arrested for even trying this. And my friend Barry got out of the driver's side and walked over and stuck like 20 pesos in this guy's hand, to which I thought to myself, oh, now we're really going to be in trouble, right? And he walked in the customs to the place, and they said, the owner of the car, and he's in Spanish, we got that much out of it, and he said, Senor Michael Brown, and they filled out the form, Michael Brown, he said, gracias, and we were off. So we knew right on day one that was the protocol. Of course, we're talking about 1970, you know, so this is a few years ago. So I guess we all have a little larceny in our hearts. And, you know, there's a family legend in my family that my father got some kind of ticket and went before the judge. And my grandmother went and pleaded on his behalf because he was a salesman. And my grandmother said to the judge, you can't suspend his license, because if you do, he won't be able to feed his family. He needs his car. And then as she left the court, she gave the judge $20 and said, buy yourself some cigars. And my mother evidently heard this and said to her, oh, my God, Mom, you tried to bribe a judge. You bribed a judge? And she looked at my mother and said, he kept the $20, didn't he?
Yeah, oh, my
but,
God.
Like, stay out of it. You know, and I'm sure, you know, if I had to guess, I'm sure he kept the $20 because she was 83 at the time and probably reminded him of his grandmother and probably gave the money to the Police Benevolence Association or something. One would hope, yeah. Of course, it was North New Jersey, so you never can tell.
Well, my dad told those stories about him growing up in Chicago. And running lights and being pulled over and just putting money in the cop's hand and off they'd go. It was the bad old days, but you could buy your way out of things. I wonder if Chicago hasn't changed much, has it?
I don't know. My daughter lives out there, and she's certain that the guy that she tended bar for was the son of a mobster who didn't know anything about the bar business. But things certainly, you know, when I was a kid in North New Jersey living in the Italian neighborhood, certainly organized crime was still there. I mean, we didn't see it like they saw it in my parents' day. It wasn't as visible, but certainly it was still there. And I guess it still is there. Look, there was just a guy murdered in Staten Island. Did you read about this?
Yeah. I didn't. No.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mob boss, head of the Gambino family, was shot and killed outside his house, right? And in Staten Island, they say it was the first mob hit in 30 years. So I guess they're still out there somewhere, and certainly we see it every once in a while in the corruption. But you know what? More important than that, and more visible than that lately, has been the corruption in government. You know, that I mean, I don't know what there's a scene in the movie The Untouchables where this guy tries to bribe Elliot Ness, and he says to the guy, in ancient Rome, when someone tried to bribe a government official, they cut his nose off and then stuffed him in a bag with a live tiger or something, which in my opinion is an appropriate punishment. We just had a guy in DC plead guilty to giving away $1.5 million in food stamps in return for sexual favors and money.
You're kidding.
No.
You know what I don't get? And forget ethics and morals and integrity and a conscience and stuff. You have to be stupid to think you're going to get away with it. In this day and age with surveillance and electronics and Alexas and Google Home, and you're going to get caught.
Well, you know, you would think that you would have, when you're called to government service, that you would have some sense of, you know, because that's $1.5 million that you can be sure didn't go to the right people.
Right.
And, you know, and that's the real horror. But we should end our show with a luminary like Eleanor Holmes Norton by talking about this stuff, I think. Let's end, because we're getting close to the end of the show, by talking about St. Patrick's Day. Today's St. Patrick's Day. We know Maria's having, you have any leftover? You don't have any leftover.
No, no leftovers. Going for sushi tonight.
Sushi.
And green sake. Okay.
All right. Well,
yeah.
I'm going to have corned beef and cabbage. Thanks to Mrs. Brown. And you know, it was so great to have the Congresswoman on the show tonight. And future shows we're going to have, we hope to have a legislator from Maryland on the show and a presidential candidate who we will announce in the future. And so we hope that our loyal listeners will continue to listen out there. And
you know, Michael, one of the themes of the guests have been fiercely strong and powerful women.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, Michael Steele, you know, was the exception, if you will, because in general, the guests have been these women that are not only pioneers, but in the forefront with their careers, with their education, with what they've done, with their social activism. It's been just such a privilege to be invited to the party, because wow, I admire them. You know, I'm nonpartisan in my admiration of people who are game changers. So I don't care what their political affiliation is. It's like I watch their actions, their decisions, their choices, their behaviors, and they've been exemplary.
Well, I think there's two reasons for that. I think one is that we have a co-host who's a strong, accomplished woman who keeps on being out there working hard to make her life better every day. I mean, you know, you're working on your doctorate degree.
Speaking of which, Wednesday,
inspiration.
Wednesday, yeah. Thank you for that, was registration for classes for the next semester, which is the last time I will be registering for classes because I start my dissertation the following semester.
Yay!
Yeah,
well,
I mean, it was historic.
And let me say also that I've always been attracted to strong women, and I think that this I blame this on Rita Sarcone, who in the third grade beat the crap out of me. I was in love with her, and she beat me up on the playground every day, and ever since then I've had a thing for strong women. So Rita,
well,
if you're out there.
Of wife indicates that as well. I mean,
right.
Ms. Brown is a phenomenal woman and human being and accomplished and educated and successful in her own right.
And she carries on the legacy of Rita. She's still beating me up on a regular occasion. Believe me, Rita would be proud to have tagged Mrs. Brown in.
However, this time it's consensual.
Well, you know, there's consent and then there's being beat into submission. I think those might be two different things. But of course, I'm lucky to have Mrs. Brown in my life, and she is all those things. And it's funny that you should talk about signing up for your last class. She spent the whole day today getting ready for her class because in the summer she teaches at Catholic University. And so this is this may be the last summer that she does that too, because she's getting tired of it, I think. But she made, if I can brag a little bit, associate professor this year. So at Catholic.
Yay!
So,
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and You know, so it's time to go. And before we, tonight we're going to leave you. I hope you don't think this is too corny, America. But, you know, we always leave you with this song. And tonight it's one of my favorite Irishmen, Bing Crosby, with Irish Eyes Are Smiling. But before we leave, Maria, please, the last word to you.
Just a continued thanks for the support and the sharing the program with your friends and for your loyalty as a listener for keeping us in your life. We appreciate that. We're very grateful, frankly.
Absolutely. See you next week.
Yes. Have a great week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.